Lutheran Talk.
We have an ecumenical responsibility to hold forth the scriptures and to bear witness to grace alone, faith alone, Christ alone.
Lutheran Music. Listen anytime, anywhere in 2020 with the Lutheran Public Radio mobile app. Download for iPhone, Android, and Kindle at issuesetc.org.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes.
Go on to the average university campus. You could talk to a philosophy professor or a gender studies professor, or maybe even an English professor, who knows, perhaps even a math professor, and ask them, what is truth? Where does truth come from? Is truth something that is objective? Is reality even objective? Or is it all just a phenomenon of our mind, or maybe even a construct or creation of our mind? You'd be surprised. And then if you went into, say, the quad and asked a few students, you might be shocked. There is a new mindset that has taken over from postmodernism, postmodernism's child, constructivism, where we construct our own truth and reality and just about everything else. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to begin a series on a Lutheran response to post-Christian culture. Dr. Gene Edward Veith will join us. We're going to talk about constructivism versus objective reality. Dr. Veith is a regular guest. He's provost and professor of literature emeritus at Patrick Henry College. Previously served as culture editor for World Magazine. He's director of the Cranach Institute at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and author of numerous books, including his latest, Post-Christian, A Guide to Contemporary Thought and Culture. Dr. Veith, welcome back.
Oh, good to be with you again.
We've talked for years about postmodernism. Mm-hmm. And you note early in the book that postmodernism didn't end in that brief moment of moral clarity that followed the 9/11 attacks. What happened instead?
Well, I wrote a book called Postmodern Times back in 1994, A Christian Guide to Contemporary Thought and Culture. And this new book, Post-Christian, is a sequel to that. And I really thought that postmodernism was over at 9/11 because, as you said, for a moment, there was moral clarity. People weren't talking like moral relativists. You know, those planes coming out of nowhere into those buildings, that wasn't a truth that we constructed out of our own minds. And there was a time of unity and moral clarity. And it lasted for just a little while. But then postmodernism came back, only it kind of mutated. It became harder and more extreme and more radical. Before 9/11, people would talk about other religions. All religions are equally valid, and your religion is as good as mine, and it's all fine, which wasn't true, of course, but it was a tolerant view. Now, after 9/11, people were saying, not all religions are equally good. All religions are equally bad. And that Christians who really believed in their faith, they're as bad as the Muslim terrorist. Fundamentalism, by which they meant any conservative Christian, that's the problem. And so it became more politicized. People used to allow for different arguments. Now, when you try to have a rational discussion with somebody, it gets politicized. It's a matter of power. You're trying to impose your view on somebody else. And it's just been taken to some new extremes and applied in some different ways as new issues have come up. And so I try to deal with those too in this new book.
What is the problem with the term post-Christian?
Well, my book is a study of contemporary secularism in all of its facets. And the part of secularism means that we don't need religion, or at least we don't need religion in the public sphere. Maybe if you keep it private to yourself, that's one thing, but we can do without religion. Now, in reality, they can't. And we see secularism in its different facets is run into dead ends and failures and looking for something beyond. But this is not really a post-Christian age in the sense that that sounds like Christianity is over. And Christianity is not over. But I think in this attempt to try to do without it, its true strength and truth may be brought out more than ever in a new contemporary context.
Why do you find the term post-secular intriguing and useful?
Yeah, that's just it. Because as I studied the secularist, the real cutting-edge thinkers in just about every field are recognizing the dead end they've come to. I mean, if all truth is a construction and we just make up our own truth, what is there to know? Where do we go from here? If it's all just political power, then how can you have any kind of civilization or even moral claim or even social justice claims? And so some of the cutting edge figures are looking, okay, what's going to be after this? What's going to get us beyond this impasse we have? And people are using the term post-secular. And some of them are saying that we need to come to terms with religion in some way. They don't usually have a clear sense of what that even means or how to do that or what it entails. But I think that's a very hopeful sign. You know, things look very bleak for Christians in so many ways today. But a lot of these secular trends and secular ideologies are self-destructing. And even the secularists are starting to look for a way beyond that, that they're calling post-secular. If I ever live long enough to make a sequel to this book, which I probably won't, I hope I can call it post-secular. And maybe it can be a more hopeful book.
What is, and you mentioned this just a second ago, what is the constructivist view of truth and reality? That's kind of the framework for this whole conversation.
Yeah. Well, constructivists believe that truth is something we create in our own minds. Okay. Classically, truth is the reality out there. Our minds can learn about truth or maybe study it and research and try to find out what's true, and whether that's the truth of science or the truth of history or the truth of religion. Truth was seen as outside ourselves. Now, the postmodernists started teaching that we all create our own realities, that we construct truth. And so, of course, one truth is as good as another because different people construct different truths. And that's the basis of a lot of what I call postmodern thought that's really been accelerating in so many other areas. I mean, for example, now, even the body, even whether you're a man or a woman, you can't bring in objective physical characteristics. My gender is something I construct for myself, and that is my gender according to my choice. And that can change. We have the gender fluid now who change their gender maybe from one day to the next. But it's a completely different orientation in which we make up our own realities, and that is the truth, at least for us, and that's claiming the status of truth.
The Age of Reason or the Enlightenment, and I'm talking about that time ushered in by men like Locke and Berkeley and Hume, it was known for its empiricism. How did it devolve into constructivism?
Well, first of all, the Age of Reason was not the first people to use reason. The classical thinkers, medieval scholastics, they pushed reason about as far as you could go. But in the Enlightenment, the idea grew up that it's reason alone. Reason alone is all we need to find truth. And they were still thinking of truth as an outside world. And this was accompanied by the rise of science and many wonderful things. But there came a point where kind of the model of it, you know, nature, the world is there, and we're a disembodied mind, you know, looking at it. Now, you had the deist who believed that God created the world, but then is basically a disembodied mind looking at his creation. And people started thinking of human beings kind of in the same way. You know, we talk about human beings trying to become God. The God they were trying to become was the deistic God in many ways. You look with detachment. You look from a distance. You're not part of what you're studying. But if you do that, then it's actually becomes a very subjective way of thinking about things. Your own mind is the criteria. If you can understand it in your own mind, that's real. Things you can understand, like the mysteries of faith, for a big example, that doesn't enter into it. It's only what my mind can understand that counts for being true. And then the Enlightenment thinkers started looking at the mind, looking at that process. And the key figure in that was Immanuel Kant, who in many ways is the highest point of the Enlightenment rationalist. But he was also the beginning of the constructivist, because he said that the mind actively shapes what we perceive. And of course, he's right in many ways. If you just believe what you see and what your mind says, then you have to believe that things get smaller as they're farther away from you. They don't get smaller. This is just the perspective of our minds. That's how we perceive things. So our mind takes in that things are looking smaller, but our intellect then can figure out that, no, that's just a matter of distance. And Kant explored things like that and argued that the mind has these categories. It gets sense impressions from the outside, but then the mind shapes it into ideas and categories and truths and so on. Kant said that we cannot know the outside world as it really is apart from our minds shaping it. And so that's basically constructivism. It was a small step to take then to emphasize this active role of our mind, to saying that our minds construct truth or construct the reality that we know. And that point with Immanuel Kant, he was both the transition between rationalism and constructivism, and he sort of embodies both at the highest level. And contemporary thinkers have been then taking Kant and applying him in all kinds of other ways, bringing in culture, bringing in power relationships, and looking at how people and the culture constructs morality and everything else. And that's kind of where we are.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith is our guest. It's part one of a series with him on a Lutheran response to post-Christian culture. We will talk about Marxism and deconstructionism next. You can compare what each gospel writer wrote about Jesus and his ministry in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. It's titled Jesus, A Study of the Words of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Jesus, A Study on the Words of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John costs $14.99. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, Jesus, A Study on the Words of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
This is a short ad, and I don't have time to explain the whole thing to you, but you and your family need a good Lutheran church. You need this for spiritual nourishment and training, and for the support and community that comes from like-minded Christians. Your children need Lutheran friends who can become Lutheran spouses. If you don't have that where you live, you should move. One of the places you should consider is Fort Wayne, so that you can attend Redeemer, maybe send your kids to Redeemer Classical School, or just get your homeschooled kids involved with the school. Besides the church, Fort Wayne has lots to offer, including jobs. If you want to talk to families that have done just this, picked up and moved to Fort Wayne for the sake of the church, we can introduce you to some. And if you want to come for a visit, we can even help with housing. Life's too short and your children are too precious to live where you aren't spiritually fed and cared for. Your job, your income, is not the most important thing in your life. Find Redeemer Lutheran in Fort Wayne on the internet and drop us a line. We'd love to help.
This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children. Concordia Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're devoted to our Lutheran confession and committed to strong academics. Please encourage your child, grandchild, or godchild to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll study Jesus washes the disciples' feet. One of you will betray me. A new commandment. Let not your hearts be troubled. And Jesus, the image of the Father. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, as we continue our walk through St. John's Gospel on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by becoming an Issues Etc. congregational sponsor. Bethlehem Lutheran, North Zulch, Texas. Faith Lutheran, Rogue River, Oregon. Grace Lutheran, Warminster, Pennsylvania. Emmanuel Lutheran, Pensacola, Florida. Mount Olive Lutheran, Duluth, Minnesota. Pilgrim Lutheran, Kilgore, Texas. Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Rathdrum, Idaho. St. Matthew Lutheran, Hawthorne Woods, Illinois. The Good Shepherd Lutheran, Inglewood, California, and Zion Lutheran, Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Find out how your confessional Lutheran church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Support, Donate, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes an Issues Etc. sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal.
She is the publisher of a pro-life newspaper. All the passages within this paper, which she's the owner and co-editor, but she's the owner, every single one of them is against abortion.
You're saved not by your own machination, your own way of doing things, as they try to do with Abraham and Hagar, but rather you are saved by what God does, His promise.
Or let's say somebody who grew up in poverty, who grew up, let's say, in a minority community, we don't tell them, oh, exclude from your personal identity all your experiences growing up poor and growing up in a minority community.
And so Paul says, with this in mind, not being afraid to live or die, not being afraid to suffer, not being afraid of whatever will happen to me, I live for the kingdom of God, looking for the resurrection, and that's how you should live. Also, that's what they are to imitate.
An hour from now, we'll play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. We'll play those four soundbites for you in their entirety. After you've heard them, you'll give us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE, or go to our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, and your vote will decide which will be Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. It's part one of a series with Dr. Gene Edward Veith on a Lutheran response to Christian culture. He's author of numerous books, including his latest, Post-Christian, A Guide to Contemporary Thought and Culture. Dr. Veith, the other side of constructivism is, of course, deconstructivism. The poster child for that is Marxism, which was originally applied to economic systems, but it's been far more broadly applied lately, hasn't it?
That's right. In the academic world, if truth claims or constructions, what you do to analyze them is to show how they're constructed. That's to deconstruct them. So you take a document like the Declaration of Independence. Okay, let's deconstruct it. Well, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. Well, and then show, but wait a minute, men, not women. Look what's excluded. All men are created equal. Well, but this was put together by slave owners. And to show these contradictions. And not only that, and here's where Marxism comes in, the power relations. The view came that the culture constructs meaning, and also the people in power in that culture are the ones that really construct the meaning that everybody else then buys into. And so that started with Marxists talking about how everything, all of culture, all of civilization, everything reflects the class struggle. You know, the fairy tales, knights rescuing fair maidens. They'll say, well, see, that's reflecting the feudal structure because the knights are the upper class, and these works are teaching the peasants to look up to their feudal masters, and that keeps the feudal masters, the knights and nobles and kings, in power. And then it goes on with the middle class who owns property, and you know, with ideas like independence and freedom. Well, those are thought to be middle class values designed to exalt them and keep the lower classes in their place. But now it's applied not just in economic terms. The post-Marxists, who are now kind of dominating a lot of this discourse, are apply that kind of analysis to every kind of group, which they see as one group has privilege, another group is oppressed. So men oppress women, white people oppress racial minorities, class does it enter into it, the rich oppress the poor, humans oppress animals, heterosexuals oppress homosexuals, people with a natural gender oppress those who are transgendered or gender fluid. And so they deconstruct things in terms of these power relationships, which again makes it all also politicizes everything. And, you know, sort of traditional civilization becomes the casualty.
This is largely in academia, but of course it's found in all levels of education. How does constructivism do education?
Well, there's a constructivist educational theory that's kind of the dominant theory right now for teaching, you know, grade schools and teacher education programs. And this is the idea that you teach, I mean, if everything is constructive, what do you teach? Well, you teach children to construct their own meanings. And sometimes there are curriculums where they construct their own math rules, for example, suggesting that, you know, there's an arbitrary kind of set of operations that you do so that you can have other kinds of math rules that then you work out into their own answers. You construct your own spelling rules. You can write your own textbook. Instead of reading a book written by a skillful author, children will often, you know, dictate a story. The teacher will write it down, and then they learn to read it. Now, a lot of constructivist education is no more than, you know, discovery, which is a very traditional way of learning, where they're trying to find the answers for themselves. But it's called and labeled constructivism because that's the intellectual buzzword that sort of organizes a lot of contemporary thought. But it also results in bad education. You know, if you measure then what a student can do, how good their math is, how good their spelling is, if they're trained in these constructivist methods, it doesn't result in much achievement. Now, there are some students who are very sharp and who pick up the game and figure it out themselves, and they can do well. But for most students, it really has resulted in kind of a collapse of American education.
How does constructivism do ethics?
Well, and notice how the abortion debate is carried on. You know, the people who believe in abortion, they don't say, I'm pro-abortion, I'm pro-choice. I'm pro-choice. And so in postmodern ethics, in constructivist ethics, it's if there's a choice, that makes whatever you choose right. Now, that doesn't mean that everything is right, because if somebody interferes with someone's choice, they are wrong, they are evil. So people who oppose abortion and want to limit a woman's, quote, choice, they're bad and demonized. But if a woman chooses to have a baby, that's right for her. If she chooses to get an abortion, that's right for her. As long as there's a choice, that makes it fine. And this is applied to many other areas. Obviously, euthanasia and assisted suicide. If people choose to die, then why shouldn't they? But it's also, we're seeing it now in sexual ethics. What makes some sex act right or wrong is whether there's consent. In other words, whether a choice to do that. Now, if there is no consent, obviously it's wrong. But consent validates everything. Now, the problem is what they're running up against is that, first of all, Christianity always has taught, has agreed with that, the importance of consent, for example, in marriage. That's why in the marriage ceremony you have the words, you know, do you take this man to be your husband? Do you take this woman? And the I do, that's a very key part of a marriage service and of the whole moral and legal structure of how marriage is set up. Of course, consent is essential. But now to try to make that the criteria in sexual relationship outside of marriage, it doesn't work so clearly. Because whether consent was given, that's not always clear. And sometimes consent is given and then taken back. And what we're seeing in some of the Me Too trials is that these, you know, monsters like Weinstein forcing women to have sex with him by coercing them, by, you know, offering them a part in this movie, and if they don't, they'll lose their work. So did they consent if they agreed to do that because they're being manipulated to do it for their career? Well, they may have given consent, but it's not really consent. It's a coerced consent. But anyway, when you get out of clear, you know, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not commit fornication, there should be no sex outside of marriage, you run into all of these quandaries. And I mean, in a way, in the book, this is an example of secularism kind of falling into its own contradictions. Because in the matter of sexuality, you have, back in the sexual revolution, sex is no big deal. And so now, though, people are realizing in the Me Too era, sex is a big deal. And they're having trouble sorting out how people need to behave toward each other in terms of their constructivism is not working very well. And again, you really see the need for kind of objective sexual morality again.
We're talking with Dr. Gene Edward Veith, beginning a series with him on a Lutheran response to post-Christian culture. He's authored the new book, Post-Christian, A Guide to Contemporary Thought and Culture. Why has the scientific method until now really proven to be a good guard against constructivism? We'll get his answer to that question next.
We need to be able to articulate from the scriptures very simply the clarity and the confidence of the doctrine that there is one God, and that God the Father is God, and God the Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, is God, and God the Holy Spirit is God.
Pastor Brian Wolfmiller talking about his presentation at the 2020 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And we want to make that case with a simplicity that comes from the Scripture, and we want to consider then the beauty of what it means to worship the Holy Trinity.
You can meet and hear Pastor Brian Wolfmiller making the case for the Trinity at the annual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 12th and Saturday, June 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. Pastor Wolfmiller will be joined by Dr. Robert George, Mark and Molly Hemingway, Pastor Hans Feeney, Dr. Albert Moeller, and Pastor Will Whedon. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org or by calling 618-223-8385.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
We're beginning a series with Dr. Gene Edward Veith on a Lutheran response to post-Christian culture. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Concordia University Chicago is the site of the 2020 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, June 12th and Saturday, June 13th. Speakers will include Mark and Molly Hemingway, Robert George, Albert Moeller, Will Whedon, Brian Wolfmiller, and Hans Feeney. Early bird registration is $135, and that includes meals on Friday night and Saturday afternoon and evening. We only have room for 500 attendees. Find out more at issuesetc.org or by giving us a call, 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 12th and 13th in Chicago. Dr. Feith, why has the scientific method, probably more than less, proved to be a guard against constructivism?
Yeah, it's very interesting to look at the scientific method as it was developed and formulated. And you can see that one of the things they're trying to do in the procedures and techniques that scientists are expected to follow is to prevent bias, prevent the bias of the scientist from shaping the data, because it's so easy to do. And so in the scientific method, you have to have controlled experiments, double-blind experiments where the scientist doesn't know which variable he's working on at a particular time. Experiments have to be reproducible. So if someone else does the same experiment, they should get the same results. And so a lot of that is actively kind of trying to prevent that constructivist mind from shaping things like it tends to. And so it's been very successful in being rigorously empirical, trying to look at the outside world as it is, and to draw conclusions from that, hypotheses, in achieving great result. But they had to do a lot to safeguard their processes from this constructivist impulse. And even now, though, there's a big scandal in science that so much of it is not reproducible. This is a huge thing in the field of psychology and the social sciences. Big percentage of the psychological experiments, when someone else tries to do them, they don't get the same results. Of course, this is because human beings are different from each other. We're complex. One of the things you have to be careful about in that kind of rationalist, reducing everything just to reason, is that human beings are different from each other. So, of course, they're not necessarily going to respond the same way when you have two different groups of people. But we're now finding this even the sort of the scandal and reproducibility, even in the hard sciences, even in medicine, and even in chemistry, biology. And scientists are trying to get their hands on why this is and try to figure out what to do about it. But science remains a human enterprise, and the human part of it often keeps insinuating itself.
With the scientific method having proven as a guard against constructivism, does that mean that the sciences, even the hard sciences, have been immune to constructivism?
Yeah, no, not at all. The part of the scientific method is to form a hypothesis, which is a model, a mental model, that then you check by means of experimentation. And where do those hypotheses come from? Well, they come from a lot of places, but they're a human, and scientists often even use that term, a construction. And so you have data, and then you have to come up with a paradigm or a model to account for all that data. And that's very much an imaginative task, a construction of the mind. I talk about evolution, for example, which is a dominant model that scientists are using to try to explain just about everything. But evolution did not just begin with Darwin accounting for empirical evidence. One of the best pieces of literature about evolution, Tennyson's In Memoriam, was written 10 years before Darwin's theory of evolution was ever published. And the ideas of evolution were in the air and go back for centuries even. And then Darwin applied that to the origin of species. And so in many ways, you can look at the theory of evolution as a construction. And of course, it was shaped by especially the economic revolution, again, the industrial revolution, capitalism, which basically Adam Smith's view about economic competition and how the best companies will survive because of that competition and the economy will grow. I mean, Darwinism is basically Adam Smith applied to biology. Is that a purely scientific hypothesis? I'd say no. And there are a lot of other factors about it. So constructivism, the human mind, including the limits of the human mind, and the people are influenced by all the things they're influenced about, that doesn't take away the real accomplishments of science. But it means that science, even like many other intellectual enterprises, changes and has to keep changing and has to keep growing, and the things that it finds out are helpful for us to build on, but you can't turn it into a religion, as a lot of people try to do.
Well, let's talk about that briefly then. In what ways has science become a substitute for religion?
Well, a lot of people you talk to today, they maybe don't know much about science, but they will believe that science has dethroned religion, that science will solve all of our problems, that the only truth that's really reliable is scientific truth and everything else is just made up. And they put their trust in science, assuming that science will find a way to deal with this problem or that problem. Or if we just progress farther enough, we'll go beyond that. And of course, the word science simply means knowledge. The other side of the coin is technology, which is not the same as science. Technology comes from the Greek word techne for tools. And technology is what we make, what we construct. And so we can construct things to overcome the limits that we have. Our technology is tremendous, obviously, today, and it's a great gift. But you can see how constructivists would be more interested in technology than science. The modernists were all about scientific reasoning. They love science. Postmodernists love technology because it is constructivist, because we're constructing things and there are human creations and they let us do a lot of things according to what we want, according to our wills. And so technology, I think for most people today, even more than science, is sort of the new religion. And there are new technological religions they get into in the book. Talk about those when we get to that, I guess. But the belief in artificial intelligence, and there are even new religions started that will worship artificial intelligence as a god, and you'll attain immortality by downloading your consciousness into the internet where it will live forever. And so you have all of these kind of religious ideas and desires sort of projected into technology and expecting them to satisfy all of that, which it will not and cannot do.
Dr. Jean Edward Veith is Provost and Professor of Literature Emeritus at Patrick Henry College. He previously served as culture editor for World Magazine. He's director of the Chronic Institute at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and author of numerous books, including his latest, Post-Christian, A Guide to Contemporary Thought and Culture. When you purchase this book using the Amazon link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Talk On Demand Archives, and look for Post-Christian, A Guide to Contemporary Thought and Culture by Dr. Jean Edward Veith. Dr. Veith, thank you.
My pleasure.
In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. on this Friday, January the 24th, we'll be with Pastor Chris Rosebro. Our weekly feature, This Week in Pop Christianity Today, the Word Faith Teaching of Rhema and Logos. They think they hear from God in both words of God, but they think they can make a distinction between the two. Then we'll play Issues, Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.